It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a look at calls to change the way Wisconsin divides up election districts and elect state legislators.
First, as we hear fears of the outbreaks of diseases like malaria and dysentery in the aftermath of the typhoon in the Philippines, a recent report finds that those and other widespread and lethal diseases are not getting a lot of attention when it comes to developing medications.
We've got Dr. Natalie Strub-Wargaft with us now. She's medical director of the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative, co-author of the report we're talking about. Natalie, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, thank you.
So first of all, what are some of the neglected diseases you're talking about in your report?
Yeah, well, you know, generally these neglected diseases are diseases of the very poor that live in very poor countries, developing countries. They are very abandoned, they're voiceless. No one really knows about them. So one of these diseases that people would know about is the sleeping sickness caused by the tsetse fly. This is a fatal disease. Patients will die without proper treatment. And most of these patients who live very far from the places where they could get some injectable treatment do not get the way, you know, not get there on time to get treatment, so could die out of it.
How big an impact in total do these diseases have?
Well, if we look at the burden of disease, which is in fact looking at the weight of morbidity or mortality caused by these diseases, they represent as much as 10.5% of the overall disease of all the world, of all conditions, if you wish.
So about how many people, roughly, are we talking about?
We're talking about hundreds of millions of patients.
Hundreds of millions. And so the neglected diseases concept relates to drug production for these diseases. How many of the new drugs that come out each year target the diseases you're talking about?
Yeah, well, that's the point of the report. In fact, we looked at, you know, the development of drugs during the past 10 years. And what we found is that despite the fact that 10.5% of these patients suffer, only 4% of new drugs, including vaccines, are developed for these patients. So it is totally unbalanced. There's a big gap here. And this is because these patients do not represent, a profitable market. They will not be able to pay. So, in fact, for those who are developing drugs to get some benefit, there is no financial return on the investment.
And you mentioned sleeping sickness. Before we get to solutions, can you name a few of the other major diseases that are neglected and not seeing this drug manufacturing?
Yeah, well, there is the Kala-Azar, visceral leishmaniasis. There are some Hellman's infections, worm infections. There's Buruli ulcer, which is a very annoying and cutaneous disease. There is mycetoma. There is also Chagas disease. There are, in fact, 49 of these diseases if you look at the whole list. WHO has selected 17 out of them, but in fact, we looked and there are many more.
So the big question, why, if these diseases are killing people in the hundreds of millions, don't we see more research and development of drugs and vaccines?
Well, that's the point. I think, you know, there is no real benefit for any pharmaceutical or biotech company to develop a drug that cannot be bought with some kind of benefit. So that's where the main gap lies, and this is why a few of organizations like the NDI have been created in the past decade to try and find other ways of developing drugs or vaccines for these patients by making partnerships, by sharing information, finding new ways of doing things.
So what kind of efforts are out there? Expand on that a little. Who, if not independent research by drug companies, who takes the lead here?
Well, if you take the NDI, we look into libraries that we have, chemical libraries of pharmaceutical companies. For instance, we look at drugs that they are not interested in anymore. And we try and see if these drugs would have some potential for the diseases that we are interested in. And then we find the right people to develop them, to test them in the laboratory. So we've set up some external partnerships to get all the people together to develop them. And then we go in the countries, and with the countries, we develop them and we test them in patients.
So that's interesting. There might be drugs on the shelf already at some pharmaceutical companies, maybe not completely researched yet, but we're not starting from square one.
Oh, totally. I mean, we have a treatment that is now tested in sleeping sickness in patients, and that was a drug at that time that was not developed because for reasons we don't know about, but nothing wrong with the drug, but it didn't seem to have some potential for that company, so it was just abandoned. There are a few of these, and we are very, good, and others too, in trying to find them and making something good out of them. But you can also look at drugs which exist for a disease A and try and see if it would work for disease B, for example.
So it seems like part two of this, even if you get the drug out there and in place, is distribution, getting it to the people who need it. As you mentioned, maybe in a remote area without a lot of money and without a lot of medical infrastructure.
Absolutely. And this is why, when we design a plan for treatment, the first thing we do is to work with the partners and the treating physicians in the countries and those who will be in charge of treating patients to see what are the minimum criteria for them, to be able to deploy. And one of them is the cost and the price of the treatment. So this is something we're very vigilant about. And also the practical things as having an oral treatment, because if you have an injectable infusion that no one can access to and be treated with, there's no point.
Are we seeing improvement over time? Is the world getting better, at least at producing these drugs?
I think we should say the world is getting better, but it's really not on track yet.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about a related issue. We saw that today is something called World Toilet Day, started by the United Nations. Seems strange and puzzling at first, but it's this international effort to provide better sanitation in a lot of parts of the world. Is sanitation, is something like that a part of the answer to the diseases we're talking about, along with the drugs, the medications, the vaccines?
Well, of course, this is a very, it seems minimal to us, but to avoid, look at cholera, look at all these diseases that are transmitted by poor sanitation and by infections. And there are other like schistosomiasis or other diseases which are not related to just directly sanitation, but indirectly, certainly, yes. So it's, of course, all of these efforts are needed, and there was a Tropical Medicine Congress past week in Washington, and all these issues were well discussed.
So to wrap up, a lot of the drug research happens, as you mentioned, here in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, and a lot of the diseases you're talking about don't. Is it a hard sell to get people to take these issues seriously when they seem so remote?
Yes, I would say it is. We have funding that is split between private and public, but we don't get all governments on board with this, even if we have a number of European countries. We still don't have money from the U.S. government. Of course, we have big foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that supports, and, of course, our founder, MSF, that is supporting very much. But it's always a struggle to get money. And there's not, we need money for all these diseases. So it is a big, big struggle.
Natalie, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Natalie Strub-Wargaft, Medical Director of the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative. Right now, we're talking to a reporter about redistricting in Wisconsin. He wrote a piece today about open records requests of lawmakers involved in the redistricting process. He's here to explain what he found.
Our guest is Bill Leaders, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Veronica.
Well, the last round of redistricting happened in 2012 under a Republican-controlled legislature. What changed then?
Well, the redistricting, as in the past, has been as partisan as the people doing it can get away with. In this case, because Republicans had both houses of the legislature, they were able to redistrict to their heart's content, which did secure some of their electoral advantages in the state of Wisconsin. And in fact, the Republicans extended their control over the state legislature in both houses in the 2012 elections, even though they received fewer overall votes than did Democratic candidates statewide.
Now, in terms of a redistricting 101, you want to just run us through exactly what redistricting is?
Well, redistricting is the redrawing of voter boundaries, which happens every 10 years after the census. There's nothing illegal about the political party in charge redrawing voter boundaries to its electoral advantage. It's done all the time. It doesn't break any laws unless you redraw the boundaries in a way that disadvantage minority groups, and there's a couple of other caveats. But generally speaking, it's legal to do that, and in places where partisan politicians control the process, that's often what is done. Now, there are other places, like Iowa is the example most commonly cited, where the task of redistricting is done by a nonpartisan service agency, similar to our Wisconsin, to our Legislative Reference Bureau, and they do it without regard for how it benefits or hurts members of individual political parties. So the lines tend to get drawn a little bit cleaner in those places than they do in states like Wisconsin.
Now, in terms of when redistricting happens, it happens around the census, and I guess it seems so far to be part and parcel of what happens when a political party is in power. They try to ensure that their party stays in power, and part of that process can be redistricting. Isn't this just what the party in power does? They redistrict. They try to keep their party in office.
Yeah, well, that is what they do, and maybe it's fine that they do it. There are some people who think that Wisconsin should embrace a nonpartisan approach to the redrawing of voter boundaries, like the Iowa model, and they have introduced legislation that would accomplish this. It does have a little bit of bipartisan support in the person of Senator Dale Schultz, but it's by and large a Democrat-backed bill to create this new system. Now, the Republicans, of course, control the legislature, and they have not allowed these bills to come to a public hearing where people can testify and say whether they're against them or whether they're for them. And that has occasioned a media campaign. This is launched by a number of papers, editorial boards, and some broadcast outlets' editorial boards throughout the state. They are calling for hearings on the legislation, which would create a nonpartisan redistricting process. Wisconsin State Journal, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, many of the Gannett papers, and some broadcast outlets like Channel 3 in Madison are running editorials with some frequency calling for these hearings to be held. They've also encouraged supporters of redistricting change and of the idea that these bills should have a hearing to contact the legislators who are in a position to make that happen.
And that is something that the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism has looked at. What did you find about how much support that motion has gotten?
Well, what I did is I made open records requests of the four legislators who are most in charge of the process. Senator Mary Lasich, who is in charge of the Senate committee where the hearings would be held, Representative Tyler August, the Assembly Committee, and, of course, leaders of those bodies, Representative Robin Voss and Senator Scott Fitzgerald. And I ask for all of the communications they have received on the redistricting issue. And all I was provided with about 350 separate communications. Most of them are emails. There's some record of phone calls and some online contact forms that were provided. The largest number of these came from Senator Lasich. Of the 350 or so individual emails, which I don't think represents all of the emails that were received by these lawmakers, in some cases I saw emails that were sent to a group of lawmakers but not provided by a particular lawmaker, so there were more than what were provided. But of the ones that I was able to look at, there were five contacts which expressed support for the state's current position on redistricting, and all of the rest, the overwhelming majority, were calling for hearings and critical of the current redistricting process.
Now, based on some popular sentiment like that, a group of eight lobby groups have backed proposed legislation that you mentioned that would put the power of redistricting in the hands of a nonpartisan legislative reference bureau. How viable are those bills looking right now?
That's always been true. If you go back over the last decade and you look at the various proposals over the years to create a nonpartisan entity, it receives uniform support from good government groups, and not a single entity registers in opposition to say this is a bad idea. And yet they go nowhere. These bills don't even get hearings. They don't get votes. They die on the vine, despite having overwhelming support from members of the public who express view on it, overwhelming support from lobby groups who are working to make legislation happen. And that is played out again. There are eight groups register in favor of these bills, no group registered in opposition, no hearing, and no movement, pretty much a position from the leadership in the legislature that this is not going to happen. They do not want this to happen. It will not happen. But despite making that case publicly again and again and again, they apparently haven't persuaded many people to write them and say, way to go. We're happy with you blocking these hearings. We're happy with you keeping the current system of redistricting in place. They're not getting that feedback.
Is it fair to say, though, that because there are more records of people calling for nonpartisan oversight of redistricting instead of in support of the party in power, their redistricting plan, that means there's popular support? People, it seems, tend to voice their opinions when they're unhappy, and when they're happy, they kind of sit back and focus on other things.
Sure, and there's also the fact that newspaper editorial boards and broadcast editorial boards are encouraging people to make these contacts. But the fact is, you can encourage people to make the contacts and not inspire them to do so. In this case, people are inspired to make the contact and to try to move the legislature to, hold the hearings, allow a debate, advance the issue, at least give it a public airing. And those concerns have not found a receptive audience.
When Democrats ran the legislature, is there evidence that they made an effort to pursue this kind of redistricting that you're talking about now?
No, they blew it from their point of view. Now they're kicking themselves. There was a build during the period of time when Democrats controlled the legislature as well as the governor's office that would establish a nonpartisan method for redistricting, and it went nowhere. It died, same as the legislation is having now. The Democrats say, boy, we really made a mistake then. We should have made that happen while we had the chance, because now we see the terrible consequences that come from letting partisans redraw the boundaries. Now, you understand what happened in after the 2010 census was a little bit different from what has happened in the past, because in the past there was divided control of the state legislature at the time that redistricting happened, so no one party was able to just grab the reins and get what they wanted. It ended up in the courts, and it was costly and protracted, but nobody emerged with their vision intact. With the last redistricting process, it did happen that one party was in charge of all of government, and they were able to put their stamp on the redrawn boundaries completely.
Given that there is only, it looks like, slim bipartisan support for this, are you seeing any indications that this is legislation that has a shot, or do you think this is just sort of a hope and a prayer kind of thing right now?
No, I can't gauge the viability of it. I do think that people are becoming increasingly angry at some members of the legislature for not at least allowing this to come to hearing. I saw the Wisconsin State Journal refer to this as cowardly the other day, which are fighting words. I think I sense a rising sense of anger and frustration on people to, at least let the issue be heard. And that's the case that they've made by the hundreds to the members of the legislature so far without any sign that they're having an impact.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That was Bill Leaders, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
This is Central Time. A new analysis of census data shows that one in four adults 25 or older got a gift from their families for over $100 in 2012. The average amount that parents or grandparents give to their adult children, $6,500.
And we're wondering about that number. One in four growing children getting help from grandparents and parents, the amount of money, and what that says about changing family dynamics, changes in the economy, and whether this describes you and your situation. Are you an adult who gets financial support from your parents or your grandparents? Why are you getting that help? And what do you think has changed? What does it mean to you in your particular situation? We're taking your stories right now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org.
We'll go right to your calls now. We have Nicole on the line in Oshkosh. Nicole, hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling in. I am an adult who's married and actually has a six-year-old child, and we have received financial support from both of our families, actually. The reason being is that I decided to go back to school to better myself and to go to grad school. Of course, grad school is very expensive, and in order to get done in a timely fashion, I had to quit my full-time job and work part-time. So, of course, that didn't leave a lot of extra money left over. So my parents generously gave us money throughout that time, and if it wouldn't have been for them, we wouldn't have made it.
Is this a common story, you think, for your friends in the same age group?
Very common. The amount of people that need the financial support, either from their families, their parents, their grandparents, is growing. As far as going back to school to better yourself, it takes a lot now to get a good paying job. And even with the education, you're not guaranteed that you're going to be making the salary that you could have 10 or 15 years ago.
All right, Nicole, thanks for sharing your story and good luck in finding a new career.
And we go next to Tim joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi, what is your story?
Well, I almost hate to sound redundant now. I'm actually in pretty much the same boat as Nicole, except instead of returning to school, I haven't left school. I just turned 26, and I'm currently pursuing acceptance into a graduate program. I'm married. We just had our first kid 3 weeks ago, and I receive a lot of financial help from my parents and her parents. Sometimes it's not directly in the form of money. Like, her dad's a mechanic, so he'll do car work for us for free, which costs him money but saves us money.
Right. So how do you feel about taking money from your parents, from both sets of parents?
I'd have to say it does probably, it lowers my self-esteem a little bit because I feel like I'm 26. I do have a job. At this point in my life, I look at some of my other friends who didn't choose to go on to college, who just went right into the job market, and they have their own homes and they're paid off or partially paid off. And I just feel like I should be able to really be doing this on my own.
So do you blame yourself, or do you just kind of feel like this is what it is now? Maybe something has shifted.
I feel that this is what it is because it seems pretty much across the board with most of my college friends. So it makes me wonder the statistics that came out, if how much of that overlap also covers students, people who are adult children, but also happen to be in a college setting.
All right. It's a good question. Well, Tim, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. Appreciate it.
We'll go now to Eliana in Deliverance, Michigan. Eliana, hi.
Hi.
What's your story?
My story is kind of similar to everyone else's, unfortunately. I live at home, and I'm studying to take the LSAT to go to law school, so I'm pretty much completely dependent on my parents.
All right, and through law school, too, you think you'll be in the same boat?
Probably not. However, the reality is that I will most likely be taking out an incredible amount of student loans.
So you've got massive debt to look forward to. Well, good luck with the LSATs, though, and good luck with the law career. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Reed with us in Clintonville. Reed, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. So I would like to just speak to the issue of the reasons for much of this. I personally suspect that not only are young people being helped financially, monetarily speaking, but also many young people are having, of course, to move back home. and not being able to afford adequate housing. And so many issues contribute to this, the attempt to roll back the minimum wage, the issue of destroying unions that we've seen by the Republicans and our governor here in the state, which decreases salaries for young people and makes it more difficult to enter a profession that's an honorable one. And then, of course, the fact that our governor had promised us 250,000 new jobs since his first term, and we've yet to see anything close to that. And these young people are suffering, trying to go out and find a meaningful employment that allows them to succeed on their own.
All right. Reed, I want to get another call and Reed, but thank you for the perspective.
And let's go quickly to Jan in Farnham, Minnesota. Hi, Jan.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my story, I'm just feeling so blessed here after listening to everyone. I'm older. I'm 53 right now. But back when I was had graduated college, I went through college and paid my own bills and took out, of course, a lot of debt. And back when I was in my 30s, my parents, who are middle class and who never, ever struck me as wealthy in the way that they live their life and have their material possessions and so forth, you know, they never appeared as wealthy people. But they surprised us one year with a $10,000 check at Christmas time. And they did this every year for, I think about 10 years. We tried to turn the money away. We wanted them to go on trips and use the money themselves, but they just wouldn't hear of it. And we really didn't need the money. You know, we were making ends meet, although we were in debt. But they continued to give us these big gifts.
And, okay, sounds like those were important to you and something that helped you and your siblings over the years at the expense, the sacrifice of your parents. And Jan, I want to thank you so much for calling in.
You can still tell your story on the Central Time Facebook page. We're Central Time on WPR. And thanks for all your calls, by the way.
As the war in Syria continues, we take a look at a special brand of journalist, the War Reporter.
War reporters shine a light on the atrocities of war, bring them into the consciousness of people around the world, and it's a task that's become increasingly difficult in the Syrian civil war.
Last year, Marie Colvin, known as the greatest war reporter of her generation, was killed in a rocket attack while reporting in Syria. Her colleague, Paul Conroy, was with her when she died and was also injured in that attack.
After the attack, Paul returned to London to recount the work of Marie Colvin in his new book, Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's Final Assignment. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks very much for having us on. It's a pleasure.
So how did you first meet Marie Colvin?
That was just before the last Iraq war. We were both in Syria, in the northeast of Syria, trying to get into Iraq before the invasion began. And there was a group of about 20, 30 journalists all trapped, really. We couldn't get permission to cross into Iraq. And I decided to build a boat out of lorry inner tubes and paddle across. Unfortunately, I got caught and captured. And for a few days, the Syrian state police held me. But my first meeting with them was I was sat on my own having a drink after my adventures, and Marie just came in. She said, "Who and where is the boatman?" And I rather meekly put up my hand. And she came across, stuck her hand out and said, "Boatman, pleased to meet you. I'm Marie Colvin." And that was it, really. Sat down, had a drink, and she was just fascinated by the concept. It was so in her character to build a boat and try and get in that we gelled, really, over that couple of drinks that night in the bar in the desert in Syria.
And before we get into your coverage of the war in Syria with Marie, I wonder, reading the stories and the risks you go through and parting from your family, your child, what motivates someone like you and Marie to go in these dangerous situations and tell the stories there?
I mean, there's a storyteller in everybody who goes out and does this job. And war is on many levels. There are people who are experts at the geopolitical aspect of it, the politics. But the part that really touched both Marie and I was the lower level, was the people who were at the receiving end of all these bombs and bullets that are fired. And to get to that story, you really do have to go to where them shells and rockets are landing. To give them people a voice, that is what humanizes it, and that was always our endeavor, was to get to the civilians, the children, the women who had no voice, but they were just trapped, and you know, hopefully by getting them stories out, present them to the world, you know, feel that you have actually made a difference. I think, you know, it's within every war correspondent that they would like to make that difference.
When you and Marie were planning to go into Syria, I think the phrase that was used was, we're going in without papers. How do you get into a country, a war zone like Syria, without a legal border crossing?
Yeah, well, that was the option we made, the choice we made. We could get a visa from Damascus, possibly, maybe, and be, you know, stuck with their chaperones. We decided that's not what we wanted. If we were to get the truth and get them stories, we're after that. We hired kind of gun runners and Free Syrian Army people who actually wouldn't take a penny. So at midnight, 1 o'clock, we kind of tiptoed through a minefield. We're taken through deserted villages, put on motorbikes, and all of this was within 50, 100 meters of Syrian Army patrols. We could actually, you know, hear them patrols. We could hear them chattering and talking. And we were just led through smuggling routes, really, till we got into Syria, where they got us away from the border as quickly as possible.
You ended up in the city of Homs, in the siege of Homs, and Marie Colvin described this, and she's covered a lot of war zones, described it, I gather, as the worst conflict she had ever experienced. Why? What did you see there that made this such a particularly bad war zone to be in?
What was happening in Homs? Homs is a very big city, but the actual neighborhood, Baba Amra, that was being shelled, was a very small neighborhood. You know, it was two and a half kilometers long, a kilometer wide, and that was surrounded by the 4th Division of the Syrian Army, which is a very professional army. It wasn't a bunch of rebels. And what they were doing, they were just systematically going from one end of the neighborhood on a daily basis, 18 hours a day, and just systematically shelling. They get to the other end and sweep back again. There were no underground shelters, no basements. I think there were two basements in all of Baba Amra. But what they were firing in was a continual salvos of rockets, heavy 155 artillery shells, and it was a slaughterhouse. There was literally no hiding from what was happening. Whereas we'd both covered Misrata in Libya, which was a city, so you could kind of get from neighborhood to neighborhood when the shelling started. But in Baba Amra, there was none of that. They were trapped within this small zone. And we got there at day 18, I think, of this incredible, incredible bombardment. We would often count 30, 40, 50 shells per minute landing in our neighborhood. And we both just looked at each other when we got there and agreed, I've never seen anything like this. And Marie was of the same opinion.
So in the rocket attack that injured you and killed Marie, you were briefly separated from her. And then you went out to see what happened to Marie. Talk us through the moment.
Yeah, it was 7:30 in the morning, 7:30. We were getting up early to go to the field hospital. And I noticed two shells land about 100 meters either side of the building, two rockets, I'm sorry. 30 seconds later, another two rockets landed, maybe 50 meters, which blew in all the windows. And I realized I was an ex-artillery gunner for 6 years in the British Army, and I recognized the fire pattern. They were walking the shells in closer to the building, and at that point I realized the first rocket destroyed the room that Marie and I had both been sleeping in, and that was taken off the building. I ran down to grab a camera bag that was in the room, and luckily I found it. As I ran down the corridor, another rocket came through the wall as I ran past and removed another portion of the house. It was general chaos by then. It was covered in, you know, thick black chemical smoke. smoke and concrete. Another shell then hit the roof, which brought the ceiling down in on us. And we thought, I thought at that point that it was over. And just as I bent down to pick my camera up, there was an almighty explosion. I just felt like a piece of masonry had hit my leg. So I put my hand down, and at that point, my hand just went straight through my leg and came out the other side. I got a tourniquet on immediately. And then I went looking for Marie, thinking, you know, she'll maybe outside, whatever. Took about two paces and just fell in the rubble. My leg, you know, was so badly damaged, it didn't support me. And sadly, I fell next to Marie and Remy Oschlich, the French photographer. I checked Marie for signs of life. There were none. And Remy was quite obviously dead. And so I just had to lay in the rubble with Marie then for about 15 minutes because they started shelling again, trapping me outside this time. So it was about 15 minutes I had to lay next to Marie and just kind of hoped I survived the second volley that was coming in.
You ultimately survived and were able to tell us Marie's story. What would she want her legacy to be? What would she want people to look at her life and say and learn?
I really think a legacy, I mean, it's to keep on doing what we've done and what we've been doing and what Marie did. There's been a bit of a backlash since Marie died. The general press and the newspapers certainly are very wary about putting people into these situations now. And I think, you know, the thing she would want most is for it not to stop happening. You know, we must keep sending people in and getting them stories out. That I think she would be mortified at the situation at the moment, whereas nobody's allowing anybody to go in.
All right.
For security reasons, that would be the last thing she wants. You know, I know that. You know, by her dying, it's caused a fuss.
All right, Paul, thank you so much for joining us to tell her story. That was Paul Conroy, former soldier with the Royal Artillery. His new book is Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's Final Assignment.